Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week we celebrate the best of the worst. Now, usually that means that we are celebrating the absolute pits of human endeavour, but this week, for a change, we're going to celebrate the best of the topics we have chosen. So, we're celebrating a different best of the worst, and by that I don't mean we're going to do an autobiographical deep dive of Conchita Wurst, the former Eurovision Song Contest winner, nor are we going to talk our way through a variety of delightful German sausages. Instead, we're going to talk about the best examples of five topics that we covered from episodes 31 to 35. And I am joined, as ever, by my co-host, the worst to my brat, Barry McStay.
Yeah, 31 to 35 was good. I like the... I'm just looking through the topics. We did World's Worst Wife,
yep,
with Sindhu V.
Whatever happened to her?
Yeah. I like to feel like we were a launch pad. We did World's Worst TV Cartoon with Toby Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
We did World's Worst Doctor with Keir Shields. And then we did World's Worst Baker with Ed Kimber. And then finally we did the World's Worst Remake with Tom Crowley.
Tom Crowley, yeah, as well. I mean, I could say whatever happened to any of those four, because they've all gone on to extremely successful careers since.
Yeah, so what you want to do is appear on this podcast before you appear on Worst Foot Forward twice in your career. We look forward to welcoming them back. So shall we dive right in?
Yeah, let's do it. So first of all, we've got to do the world's best wife.
Our winner of worst wife was Medea,
mm-hmm,
of Greek.
Remind me what Medea did. Was it child sacrifice?
Murdered her children, I think, as a retaliation against her husband. Yeah.
Classic stuff.
Yeah, classic Greek stuff.
We talked on that episode, I think, about the World Wife Carrying Championships.
I think, yeah.
In Finland. And we may have mentioned it before, but the two most successful gentlemen in it, there's Taisto Maitinen of Finland, who has won five titles with Kristiina Harppinen.
Yeah.
And also an Estonian called, I think they might be brothers, Madis and Margo Usork. However, Madis has had three different partners. Now, it's not because he has married and remarried three different times, but because you are allowed to carry other people's wives.
Oh, I see. I was going to say, maybe, like, does it get to a point where he's like, oh, you've put on a bit of weight?
Yeah. Well, that's what I thought it was initially, which I think isn't fair, in the same way that I genuinely don't think that international football managers should come from a different nationality. And that's not me being a little Englander. If it's England versus Italy, then it should be the best of England.
Right.
Coaching staff, medical staff and players.
Sure.
I don't think that's an uncontroversial opinion.
Okay.
I also think that Brexit means Brexit. And that is, by the by, I also found out about the genesis of the competition. In 1992, it's supposedly rooted in the legend of Ronkainen the Robber.
Oh, yes, I remember this.
The leader of a hard-nosed gang who hazed potential members by making them lug sacks of grain or live pigs over a similar course.
I would watch pig carrying, actually, as a contest. Forget wife carrying.
I would like to see how the Israeli team got on. Just the pig floated ever so slightly above them.
Yeah.
But apparently, Ronkainen's gang also stole women from neighbouring villages. So this is a nod to that practice. I also, genuinely, I found it hard to search for best wives on the internet without finding some very unpleasant websites.
Oh, and just mugs. I found loads of mugs when I googled best wife.
Loads of mugs and lots of, these are the 16 best nations with the most loyal wives.
Oh.
So I found a couple of lovely husbands who clearly have such wonderful wives.
Yeah, all right.
There's a chap called Mr. Kuroki, who is a Japanese gentleman, and after 30 years of marriage together, his wife, Mrs. Kuroki, started to lose her sight. And saddened by this, he spent 2 years planting a field of thousands of pink Shibazakura flowers, or moss phlox, in their garden, so that he hoped she would enjoy the smell. And now, 10 years later, the garden draws up to 7,000 people a year.
Oh, that's nice.
And it's so beautiful. It's the a few other gentlemen have done this.
I've just looked up what they look like. Those flowers are beautiful as well.
They're really beautiful.
Very vivid pinks and purples and whites.
So I just love the fact of, like, you know, your wife goes blind and she's like, I'm going to overwhelm your other sense. Oh. It's really sweet. Maybe he took his inspiration from King Nebuchadnezzar II, who is the gentleman who built the legendary Hanging Gardens of Babylon,
yes.
which he did to cheer up his homesick wife, Amytis of Media,
yeah.
Who missed her lush nature of her native land.
And Taj Mahal is built, is a mausoleum for the wife of Shah Jahan, isn't it?
Yeah. But I'm going to suggest, as the world's best wife, Mileva Maric. Do you know who she is?
No.
She was a Serbian physicist and mathematician, and her full name is Mileva Maric Einstein.
Oh, yes, great. We were going to talk about her.
Yeah. She was the only woman among his fellow students at Zurich's Polytechnic, and the second woman ever to finish a full programme of study at the Department of Mathematics and Physics there. And as we talked about, some people cast her as the co-author of some of his early work, culminating in the very famous 1905 papers that form his Annus Mirabilis papers. One of the main reasons is, firstly, she told a Serbian friend that we finished some important work that will make my husband world famous.
Oh.
So that's the first thing there. Secondly, when it was published, the Russian physicist Abram Joff gave the name of the author as Einstein Marity, thus suggesting a dual authorship. Some people suggested he erroneously attributed the addition of the name Marity, which is Marich's official name. And people said, oh, he did it because of a Swiss custom. That custom doesn't exist. So there's every chance that she did. She was responsible for it. Equally, there's a chap called John Stackel who argues that the letters in which Einstein refers to the theory, he keeps talking about our work and our theory in those days.
Yeah.
And he argues that Einstein uses our in general statements, while he invariably used I and my when he recounted specific ideas he was working on. So it suggests that at the very least, she contributed to, you know, one of the greatest discoveries of the 20th century.
Yeah.
So that's going to be my suggestion, with, of course, the asterisk that, of course, my wife is the greatest wife in the world.
Sorry, Ben, what was that?
My wife is the greatest wife in the world.
I'm sorry, Ben, say that more clearly so the listeners can hear you say it.
My wife is adequate.
It's like trying to get you to say that Steve Bruce is a manager of Newcastle.
I love my wife very deeply and she's the best thing that ever happened to me, but Steve Bruce can get to fuck.
We've gone very similar with our suggestions of best wife, because I was trying to think of like a husband and wife team.
Mm-hmm.
Who the wife was sort of done a lot of the carrying, but they're like a famed duo, so you can go, oh, they were a good duo together. And today's the 7th of November they're recording this on, and it's exactly 152 years since the birth of Marie Curie.
Happy Marie Curie Day.
Yeah, today is Marie Curie's birthday. And so I thought of her and Pierre Curie as a great husband and wife, and in the world of physics as well, and science.
Yeah.
So Curie, I'm sure people know, her CV is lengthier than the Nobel Prize stuff we know, but she was the first woman to receive a PhD from a French university, the first woman to be employed as a professor at the University of Paris, first woman in France to defend her doctoral thesis. She was later held the position that her husband had filled as professor of general physics in the Faculty of Sciences at the Sorbonne. She was the first woman to serve in that role. And she's not only the first woman to win a Nobel Prize, but also the first person, man or woman, to ever win the award twice. And she did it for two different scientific fields as well.
That's so unbelievably good,
isn't it? She and her sister, Bronya, both wanted to go to university, but the University of Warsaw, they were born in Poland, didn't accept women, and so they'd have to leave the country. And so Marie became a governess to help pay for her sister's attendance at medical school in Paris, and continued doing it for herself as well, and funded her own journey to Paris, where she began studying in 1891. And she registered at the Sorbonne and signed her name Marie the French way, rather than Maria Salomea Sklodowska is her birth name.
Great surname.
She wanted to seem more French. She met her husband in the 1890s as well, Pierre, and married him. And they conducted experiments coating uranium with salts. And they carried out so many of their experiments basically in a garden shed, where she would spend days on end just stirring a cauldron full of like uranium slag to try and like observe the radioactive. Are you trying not to laugh at the word slag?
Uranium Slag.
Uranium Slag. It's my drag name. But she would spend days and days and days just doing stirring it, and obviously didn't lead to the healthiest of lifestyles.
That's the thing that killed her, isn't it?
Well, yeah, later on, they both said they had cracked fingers and withered hands and things. She did live into the 1930s, but yeah, she was ill for a long time. She coined the word radioactivity in 1898, and she made two observations in this paper in 1898 particularly. One, that measuring radioactivity would allow for the discovery of new elements, which it did, and that radioactivity is the property of an atom. So there were two things that she was the first person to sort of lay down. And in 1903, herself and her husband Pierre, along with Henri Becquerel, were named the winners of the Nobel Prize in Physics for helping to understand radiation phenomena. And the nomination committee initially didn't want to give her the prize. They wanted it to just be for men. But there was a guy on the committee who wrote to Pierre saying, by the way, the committee want to cut your wife out of this. And so he then wrote a letter to the Nobel committee saying, I will not accept this prize unless my wife is also...
Good man.
We are a we, not an I.
Good, that's what I like.
Yeah. Sadly, Pierre died in 1906, not of anything to do with radiation. He died in a tragic road accident. He stepped into the street and was knocked over by a horse-drawn wagon. But then they didn't keep their research to themselves. They shared it, which is it was really great. Mary said something along the lines, radium is an element. It belongs to the people. She could have made a lot of money. By the 1920s, a single gram of uranium cost $100,000. And Mary wasn't able to buy any of it to continue researching it.
That's like the guy who came up with it. Was it the smallpox vaccine? He could have made billions.
Yeah, the
I think it was that. And also Tim Berners-Lee.
Yes,
as well.
Of course, yeah. In 1911, she was embroiled in a bit of scandal. She had an affair with a married colleague who was estranged from his wife, and her husband was dead. But of course, the sexism of the time went that she was, you know, a Scottish woman breaking up a marriage. She was about to be awarded her second Nobel Prize that year for chemistry, for the discovery of polonium and uranium and radium, and the Nobel Committee discouraged her from going to Stockholm. And Einstein wrote to her with telling her of his great admiration, how glad he was to have met her recently, and that all these reports were hogwash. Ignore them, leave them to the reptiles for whom they're being written, and go to Stockholm. So she went to Stockholm and received her prize anyway. And I didn't know this: in World War I, she helped equip over 20 ambulances, 100 field hospitals with like early X-ray machines during the First World War. They were known as little Curies, the ambulances. So she was able to assist surgeons with finding shrapnel and bullets and stuff. She supervised and instructed young women on how to use them, and even drove one of them herself. And she refused a Legion d'honneur in the aftermath of the war, and even tried to offer her Nobel medals to France as like to be melted down. They were gold, to be melted down to help pay for the war and so on.
God, she's just incredible.
She's great.
I love with someone like Marie Curie, when you're like, you always know the headlines about her, but when you drill down and go, just everything she did was brilliant.
Yeah.
And she clearly never rested for a moment.
Absolutely not. And apparently, she died in the 1930s of complications from leukemia. But all of her and Pierre's lab notes and their personal belongings, a lot of them are still so radioactive now, you can't view them or study them or touch them or anything like that. I didn't know her grandchildren and children were also at the forefront of physics. Her granddaughter, I think, was a nuclear physicist in France. Her daughter, Irene, by 1925, she'd received a doctorate. And in 1935, she and her husband, Frédéric Joliot, were awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. They'd made in synthesizing new radioactive elements. Marie didn't live to see her win the award, but she had seen her daughter finish her study and conduct her research and so on. So, talented family. I don't know if there have been other parent and child winners of the Nobel Prize, but that's pretty cool as well. Husband, wife, and daughter all winning it.
Yeah, I mean, they're a pretty imposing team at the school science fair.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's Marie Curie. So I mean, we've got Mrs. Einstein and Mrs. Curie.
Yeah, it's Einstein versus Curie. It's a battle for the ages.
Cage match. A Faraday cage match, of course.
I'm going to say Marie Curie gets that one. Not least because her Marcus seems like she had better taste in men.
Possibly, yeah. Yeah, okay, well, let's go with Marie Curie. I mean, there's so many brilliant women in science that have been overlooked so much in the past. And while she's one of those who has, like you say, has got the headlines, just reading even a little bit more about her than what I already knew, and I'm already further enamored with her. Next, we did the world's worst TV cartoon with Toby Wilson. The winner was Bible Man, your choice. And I have gone for a TV show that once held the record, I don't know if it still does, for the most episodes of a cartoon comedy show. It hit its 350th episode in 2004. Scooby-Doo, in all its various incarnations.
There's 350 episodes
in 2004
of
there were 350 episodes of various different series of Scooby-Doo.
Right.
In fact, the first series of Scooby-Doo was 2 seasons and 25 episodes. Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? It returned in 1972 with the new Scooby-Doo movies. There have been 12 more series. A Pup Named Scooby-Doo, The 13 Ghosts of Scooby-Doo, Be Cool Scooby-Doo. The latest series that's on at the moment is Scooby-Doo and Guess Who, which premiered this year. And besides all of the TV shows, there have been several TV specials, 2 live-action movies, 25 direct-to-DVD movies, and 21 video games. And there's also a Lego Scooby-Doo you can now get. Do you know where the name comes from for Scooby-Doo?
Oh, I've got no idea. Go on.
Do you know what his real name is?
Oh, I do know this, and I will never remember it. Because he's a very odd breed of dog as well, isn't he?
He's a Great Dane, but he's been drawn to look not quite like a Great Dane. Yeah. Because they've made him look friendlier, basically. He was going to be a sheepdog early on. His full name is Scoobert.
Scoobert
Doo.
Oh, I thought it was going to be Scoobert Doobert.
There is an internet meme that says Scooby-Doo's name is Scoobert Doobert. It is not true.
I love stuff like that. I tried to write a joke ages ago about Argy Bargy being short for Argentina Bargentina.
That was great. I think there's a meme that originated in this decade, I think, as well, that it just went around. I think Urban Dictionary said Scooby-Doo's full name is Scoobert Doobert. And if you go back to a 1985 episode of the show, It's a Wonderful Scoob, which stars Vincent Price as Vincent Van Gool, you see Scooby, baby Scooby, in Mrs. Doo's arms in her hospital bed. There's a sign above the bed that says Mrs. Doo, so you know it must be Mrs. Doo. I read an article about this which pointed out that while it's disappointing maybe that his full name is Scoobert Doo rather than Scoobert Doobert, it is true to say that the producer of both the live-action films of Scooby-Doo is called Dick Suckle, and he was born in 1969.
That is extremely satisfying.
He also is he's a triplet. He has siblings, Skippy-Doo and Dooby-Doo. Which might give you a hint as to where the name comes from.
Frank Sinatra.
It's Strangers in the Night. It is literally Doobie Doobie Doo. The original idea for the show was called Mysteries 5, and it was going to be 5 teenagers who were in a band along with a bongo-playing dog called Too Much. Eventually, through various rewrites and re-pitchings of the show, they ended up calling him Scoobert Doo instead.
And do you know what Shaggy's real name is?
Norville Rogers.
Very good.
Yeah. He was going to be called WW originally. It's 2/3 of an internet early on. They all had different names originally, and they changed them to, Norville Shaggy Rogers, Fred Jones, Daphne Blake, Velma Dinkley, and Scoobert Doo. Vincent Price isn't the only celeb to have made appearance on it. There's a 1972 episode called Wednesday is Missing, which is an Addams Family Scooby-Doo crossover episode, and the voice of Pugsley Addams is Jodie Foster.
Wow!
Yeah, pre-Taxi Driver, obviously, and I don't know if Bugsy Malone had been out by then, but the voice of Scooby-Doo, I love reading about the voice actors and all of this, and you know the great thing, like Mel Blanc, who just voiced all these characters. The voice of Scooby-Doo was a guy called Don Messick up until the mid-90s. He was the first voice of him. He also voiced Astro, the dog from the Jetsons, Bam Bam Rubble, Barney and Betty's child in The Flintstones, Muttley, he clearly did like a line in comedy cartoon dogs, Boo Boo from Yogi Bear,
great,
several of the Transformers, Papa Smurf, and Dr. Benton Quest in Johnny Quest.
I mean, that's the equivalent of like McKellen's CV of like, I played Leah and Macbeth.
Yeah. Wasn't it great that you go like The Flintstones, Prehistoric Man, all the way up to Dr. Benton Quest in the futuristic science Johnny Quest. Oh yeah, he was succeeded by Franklin Welker in 2002, who is the only original Scooby-Doo voice actor who's still voicing the show. He's the voice of Fred and has been since the original show.
Wow.
Yeah, he voices Fred and Scooby now, of course. And he's another one who's done lots of different voices. He played Ray and Slimer in the real Ghostbusters cartoons, Megatron and Soundwave in Transformers, Nibbler on Futurama. In 2016, he was honored with an Emmy Award for his lifetime achievements. And in 2007, he became the voice of a cartoon cat. He's the voice of Garfield as well.
Garfield's got such a chewy voice.
It is
the voice of someone with a mouthful of lasagna.
Yeah, it is. Velma's line that she always comes out with, that, apart from saying jinkies, she always says, "Oh, my glasses, I can't see without my glasses." She always loses them. Apparently, the voice actor Nicole Jaffe said that at her first reading through of the script, and the writers liked it so much they kept the line.
Oh, great.
And I also read about, I liked Casey Kasem, who's the voice of Shaggy. In 1995, he's a devout vegan. He hated being the voice of Shaggy in a Burger King commercial, so he turned down doing this ad and left the role of Shaggy entirely because the producers of Scooby-Doo wouldn't make Shaggy a vegan.
I mean, he's a hippie, of course he's a vegan.
Yeah, he returned to the role eventually in 2002 when it was decided that Shaggy was a vegetarian, and you can find subtle references to it.
He returned to the role when he had problems paying his rent. Let's not mess about.
So yeah, I love Scooby-Doo, and I've loved it as a kid, and just reading all those little things about the fact that the voice is literally the Dooby Dooby Doo from Frank Sinatra, because as a kid when I heard that song I would sing Scooby Dooby Doo, not knowing that it is literally the origin of that. So hopefully I will win this section of the show, or will I be stopped by you meddling Vandervelds?
You might well be, because I do think that my suggestion is better, because I think the greatest cartoon of all time is Danger Mouse.
Yes! Oh my god, yeah, absolutely, Danger Mouse, the best cartoon.
Well, now that we've agreed on that, let me tell you a bit more about it. Non-British listeners, I cannot recommend you watching this enough.
It's all on Netflix now. Yeah, I don't know if it's on Netflix America, but it's all on the Netflix.
Both Netflix old America. And new.
Yeah, it's been revived.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was, and it was, if you're a 1980s baby, it came out in 1981. It was the cartoon soundtrack to my youth. And and it stands up so well for adults.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
The humour in it is very much like they have taken the best bits of the Goons and Monty Python and stuck them in this world of Danger Mouse, who is a master spy who lives underneath a post box at 221B Baker Street.
He's voiced by David Jason.
He is indeed. Yes. Bit of background about DM. He is often called the world's greatest secret agent, so secret that in fact his code name has a code name. He speaks 34 languages fluently, including some extraterrestrial ones. His skills are wide, including the ability to shatter metal with his voice, perform military-style push-ups with his index finger, and reach a seventh level of meditation. He is also a practitioner of the ancient martial art of Kung Moggy.
That's right.
He was originally going to be brown. However, the creators thought that he and Penfold needed to be different colours.
Penfold's his bumbling sidekick. He's a mole.
No, he's not.
Is he not a mole?
No. Many people mistake him for that. He is a hamster.
Oh.
And his nickname is Jigsaw, as he goes to pieces when a problem occurs. Colonel K, who is the bearded head of special branch.
Yes.
What animal do you think Colonel K is?
Oh, I can't remember. Is he a walrus? He's not a walrus.
He's not a walrus.
I always feel like he was a walrus.
He is in fact a chinchilla.
Oh yes, I did know that.
Colonel K previously worked for special branch when he was known as Special K.
Of course.
Colonel K is a champion piano thrower, a decorated judo expert. The first man to climb Mount Everest on a pogo stick was once an Eskimo, a former kleptomaniac, and cheats at croquet.
He sounds like a Victorian everyman who's like won an episode of this podcast.
Yes, he's the opposite of C.B. Fry.
Yeah.
He is now played in the new series by Stephen Fry.
Stephen Fry, yeah, he is Stephen Fry. Yeah.
Yeah. A couple of other characters in it. Stiletto Mafiosa, who is Baron Greenback's crow assistant, henchman.
And Baron Greenback is sort of the perennial baddie in the show.
Yeah, who was like a posh British in the original, but has become German in the new show.
Oh, yeah.
Stiletto speaks with an Italian accent in the British version, but in the American version it was changed to a Cockney accent, so that the Italian Americans wouldn't be offended. And also, all references to his surname were removed as well, but he did still refer to Baron Greenback as Barone. And it's quite obvious in several episodes there's a short silence after his first name is said, and the next word is pretty obvious. There is one other recurring character in Danger Mouse that David Jason does the voice for.
Oh, is he the little creature that Baron Greenback plays with and is his pet?
It's very good. It's Nero, the fluffy white caterpillar.
Yes.
And it's basically his voice sped up. Obviously, famously, David Jason also voiced Count Duckula,
yes,
who's a vegetarian duck vampire who appeared as a bad guy in Danger Mouse and they got his own spin-off, which is almost equally wonderful.
Yeah, that's great.
My other favourite character in it is the narrator, who is also known as Isambard Sinclair. And he very often will just halt the plot to complain about not having enough lines in the show or what nonsense it is. It's wonderfully sort of meta.
Yeah.
It was voted third in the 100 Greatest TV Shows by Channel 4, being beaten by The Muppet Show, correct, and The Simpsons, not a kids' show. How many drawings do you think were required to make each, I'm going to say, 10 to 12 minute episode?
Oh, well, 24 per second, per frames per second, so that's times 60 times 12.
Go on.
Which is... Oh, God.
Carry the two, add seven.
Yeah.
Take away the
3,500-ish?
You overshot 2,000.
2,000.
And because of that, a lot of footage was reused while certain scenes were set in places like the North Pole or in the dark.
Yes, that's right.
To save money, including, and the dark would just be black with eyeballs, or in Danger Mouse's case, one eyeball.
One eyeball, because he wears an eye patch, yeah.
Yeah. The initials DM were emblazoned on his chest, which caused some problems for other for when it was translated into other languages.
Oh, of course,
because
yeah.
Danger and Mouse wouldn't be transliterated that way. So the Scots Gaelic version of the show, he is just called Donny Murdo. Even though neither of those words are connected with mice or danger.
Yeah.
In Polish, he's called Jelena Mij, Brave Mouse. In Swedish, he's Dundermusen, Thunder Mouse.
Right.
In French, he's called Dede Motus, Dede being French slang for as fast as possible. And in Slovene, he is dubbed Hrabri Misek, Brave Mouse.
What is he in German? Just D-Mouse.
D-Mouse, yes. if you're British and you've never watched it, or if you're not British and it's not something that was ever part of your televisual childhood, I enormously recommend watching Danger Mouse on Netflix, because you can just guzzle them down so quickly and easily, and they're so charming.
They're so good. If we agree on anything on the show, it's that Danger Mouse is hands down the best TV cartoon.
Damn right.
Yeah, we did The World's Worst Doctor with Keir Shields. We chose, of course, Dr. Goatballs himself, John R. Brinkley. I'm delighted that we're able to go and, you know, correct the record and find a good doctor to recommend to people. Who have you got?
So I've gone for Sir William Ostler.
Oh, yeah.
A man I'd never heard of.
Yeah, I was the same. And then he popped up on this list of, like, brilliant doctors. And they're all, like, Alexander Fleming and people you have heard of. And then this guy is number one. You're like, who?
So he's a Canadian physician, one of the four founding professors of John Hopkins Hospital. He is basically described as the father of modern medicine and one of the greatest diagnosticians ever to wield a stethoscope. I'm not sure a stethoscope is something you should wield, but there we are. You mentioned on a show we recorded earlier today about Wikipedia's great descriptions of people, and his doesn't disappoint. He was a physician, bibliophile, historian, author, and renowned practical joker. More of that in a moment. His great advance was to take a lot of the training out of the lecture theatre and bring it onto the ward. And, you know, when you see in the telly or if you ever in hospital, the doctors go around and they take their students with them and they diagnose on the ward.
Yeah.
He was the man who invented that.
Oh, cool.
And one of his best known sayings is, listen to your patient, they are telling you their diagnosis. And he was very much of the opinion that medicine was an art, not a science, and that much of your solutions can come from the heart as the head.
Okay.
One of my friends who's a doctor says exactly that. All of the rigorous science you learn is the training.
Yeah.
You know, like footballers training on a pitch, or it's the rehearsal. And when you get on stage or the pitch or on the ward, it's you're going through the flow chart to try and narrow down what it is and is not. But then a lot of it, whether it's the art of surgery, it's not a mistake that surgery takes place in a theatre, or your diagnosis and your interaction with the patient is very much about art. Also, he was quite no-nonsense in some of his quotes. He also said, look wise, say nothing, and grunt. Speech was given to conceal thought. Which does feel a lot like the medical version of speak softly and carry a big stick.
Yeah. I like the idea, though, that if you're treating medicine as an art, you can take that too far and you go, actually, I'm just going to make it up. Do what I do when I just sit and stare blankly into space for a long period of time and call that, you know, working.
There is a worry that he could turn that into an Anabaptist interpretation of medicine. What is the answer to this? A golden throne and 1,000 virgins, please.
Yes, please.
Comes from a remarkable family. His great-grandfather, Edward Osler, was variously described as either a merchant seaman or a pirate.
Okay.
His father, Fanshawe Lake Osler, that's Fanshawe spelt Featherston.
Yes.
Son of a ship owner in Falmouth in Cornwall, and he came on to become a lieutenant in the Royal Navy who served on HMS Victory.
Victory. Oh no, he didn't.
Yeah. So that's his grandfather.
Yeah.
His father, Fanshawe, was invited to serve on HMS Beagle as the science officer for Darwin, but he had to turn it down because his father was dying.
Oh.
Fanshawe then retired from the Navy and emigrated to Canada, where he became a saddlebag minister in rural Canada.
Thus depriving his son William of the chance of serving on board the Titanic.
Yeah.
Completing the family triptych.
Yeah.
Sorry, shiptych.
Shiptych, very good. So Osler, instrumental in the creation of John Hopkins School of Medicine in 1893, and just as a sign of how effective he was, when the hospital was first created, it had 220 beds, 788 patients who were seen for 15,000 days of treatment. 16 years later, when he left for Oxford, it had 4,200 patients who were seen for nearly 110,000 days of treatment.
Ooh, yeah. Wow.
He left to become the Regius Chair of Medicine at Oxford and a fellow at Christ Church, Oxford. And as well as designing the system of doing the rounds of wards, he also created the notion of a medical residency, so the idea of doctors living and sleeping on wards and being on call 24/7, leading quite a monastic lifestyle. And he also created the pyramidal structure of having a teaching hospital at the bottom going all the way up to a consultant at the top, and that sort of revolutionised the management of hospitals and made them so much more efficient.
Amazing.
He was also a prankster, and that's what makes me love him, as well as setting all of this up. So when he was a young boy, a clergyman paid a visit to his father, and before the clergyman came in, he warned the clergyman that his dad was becoming quite deaf, and he would have to shout so that he could hear. He had also told his father that the clergyman was deaf, and he would have to shout. So these two men just yelled at each other.
That's so good.
He also said that there had to be a sense of fun on the wards as well. Whatever you do, take neither yourself nor your fellow creatures too seriously. There is tragedy enough in our daily routine, but there is room for a keen sense of the absurdities and incongruities of life. In the shifting panorama, no one sees better than the doctor the perennial sameness of men's ways.
Yeah.
But my favourite thing about him is this. He used to write under the pseudonym Egerton Yorick Davis, and he even fooled the editors of the Philadelphia Medical News into publishing a report on the extremely rare phenomenon of penis captivus. And penis captivus was
catching it in your zipper.
Catching it, yes, but not in your zipper. Catching it in a lady's vagina.
Oh, no.
When during sex the vagina would become so excited or would spasm and clamp down on the penis and not let it out.
Oh, wow.
And this got past the editors. It was apparently a response to a phenomenon of vaginismus reported 3 weeks previously by one of his colleagues, Theophilus Parvin. Great name, eh? And to make sure that the myth of his pseudonym, Egerton Davis, was continued, he used to sign his name in hotel registers and at medical conference attendee lists. He eventually killed off this character by reporting him drowned at Lachine Rapids. So he,
that's great.
He just, and there's a lovely photo of him with, I presume, one of his children. Of the and so many sort of Victorian era photos are so staid and solemn, and it's him with bald head, big old walrus moustache, and there's this little kid on his back being sort of carried round.
Candid.
Yeah, so he seems both lovely on the ward and extraordinarily warm of heart.
Very good, William Osler. I read about Robert Liston, who I think Keir talked about on the original podcast. Liston, you know, in the early 1800s, he was able to amputate your entire leg in less than 3 minutes.
Your entire leg?
Yeah, and this is pre-anaesthetics. So being able to do the job quickly was a bit of a boon.
I mean, sorry, let's just work out the logistics of that. So that is, I mean, we're talking from the hammies downwards.
Skin, bone, muscle, tendons, the whole lot.
I mean, to be fair, I'm looking at my leg and I'm like, that's, you know, that's carving through a leg of...
That's because you've skipped leg day a few times this week.
Skipped leg day a few times this decade, mate.
Robert the Flash Liston was able to have it off in no time. He'd do it sort of in front of crowds. They say, like, surgery was kind of a demonstration thing a lot of the time in theatres. He was also, as it turned out later on, the first man to conduct an operation in Europe under a modern anaesthesia using ether in the 1840s. So he probably going, it was not as good as the old days. No, he did say at the time, this Yankee dodge beats mesmerism hollow. Because it had been done first in America and then come over to Europe. But the reason I just wanted to mention is, again, I think Keir mentioned a couple of these, but there's a book by Richard Gordon from 1983 about Liston. His four most famous cases, according to Richard Gordon, and I'm quoting these verbatim below, his fourth most famous case: removal in 4 minutes of a 45-pound scrotal tumour whose owner had to carry it round in a wheelbarrow.
Oh, no.
Third most famous case: argument with his house surgeon. Was the red pulsating tumour in a small boy's neck a straightforward abscess of the skin or a dangerous aneurysm of the carotid artery? Pooh! Liston exclaimed impatiently. Whoever heard of an aneurysm in one so young? Flashing a knife from his waistcoat pocket, he lanced it. Houseman's note. Out leaped arterial blood and the boy fell. The patient died, but the artery lives in University College Hospital Pathology Museum, specimen number 1256. Second most famous case. Amputated the leg in 2.5 minutes, but in his enthusiasm, the patient's testicles as well. And Liston's most famous case, according to Gordon. Amputated the leg in under 2.5 minutes. The patient died afterwards in the ward from hospital gangrene. They usually did in those pre-Listerian days. He amputated, in addition, the fingers of his young assistant, who died afterwards in the ward from hospital gangrene. He also slashed through the coattails of a distinguished surgical spectator, who was so terrified that the knife had pierced his vitals he dropped dead from fright. That was the only operation in history with a 300% mortality. It's not entirely sure if all of those cases are true, but definitely worth mentioning. He, obviously not as good a doctor as the one I am actually going to suggest as my best doctor. In 2011, 32-year-old Carla Flores, a mother of three, was selling seafood on the street in Culiacan in Sinaloa State in Mexico, and she heard an explosion. What had happened was somebody had fired a grenade launcher. She fell back on the sidewalk and she felt a burning sensation in her face, and when she touched it there was blood in her hands, and what had happened, something had been lodged, a piece of shrapnel or something from the explosion had lodged itself in her face. A passerby grabbed her, put her in her car, drove her to the hospital, and the doctor saw there was something inside her face, on the right side of her face, but they're in an x-ray machine and it showed a weird object right in between the superior and inferior jaw bones, right in there in that cavity. It was identified by military personnel as the head of a fragmentation grenade. It was fired with a grenade launcher, which was the noise that she'd heard, and it didn't explode when it hit her and lodged in her face. And so she was in this hospital. The device could go off at any minute, killing everyone in a 32-foot radius. And so obviously hospital personnel, they isolated her, and she could barely breathe or swallow. She was, you know, her own blood and saliva was filling her mouth up. Doctors obviously didn't want to operate until the head of the hospital, Dr. Gaxiola Meza, asked for volunteers, and two anesthesiologists, a nurse, and Dr. Lydia Soto said, okay, we're going to do it. With two explosive experts from the Mexican army,
They took this lady to an open field to operate on, taking all of their surgical equipment with them, including lamps. And so if anything like went wrong, at least they'd be the only people killed. Dr. Soto operated with only a local anaesthetic, performed a tracheotomy so that the woman could breathe, and the military experts guided the doctor on what bits were, you know, explosive and what bits not to touch and so on. The doctor was not wearing any armour and couldn't rotate the thing at all, just slowly extract it from the woman's head. And at about midnight, they finished the operation. She went through several other operations after that, lost half her teeth, her face is deformed by a scar, but she lived, and she is known in Mexico as the Miracle Woman, and that is down to Dr. Lydia Soto.
That's incredible. That feels like a mashup of life-saving surgery and bomb disposal. It feels like it's come out of a Sharknado film.
Yes. William Osler or Lydia Soto. We've got one very specific case from Lydia Soto, I guess, which is immense bravery and skill. But I guess you'd say modern medicine and the hospitals wouldn't exist without William Osler.
Yeah, I mean, I'm astonished by your suggestion, but I adore old Billy Osler.
Well, we'd have to say maybe he laid the trail for Lydia Soto. Next, we talk about the world's worst baker with Ed Kimber, mm-hmm. a British Bake Off winner, and we chose the Nochmim, a Jewish group of assassins who failed to poison some Nazis by forgetting to put poison in their bread.
Still angry with him.
I read about Charles John Jochen. Do you know who he is?
No.
He was born in 1878 and he died in 1956, and he was the chief baker on board the RMS Titanic. He survived, obviously, the sinking, because he didn't die in 1912, as I just said. He first went to sea when he was only 11 years old and then became baker on various White Star Line ships, including the Olympic, the Titanic's sister ship. And he was part of the crew when the Titanic set out from Belfast to Southampton, signed on again in Southampton on the 4th of April 1912, and was in the role of chief baker, receiving monthly wages of £12. That's £1,460 a month today, which isn't bad. And he had a staff of 13 bakers working underneath him. And I don't know, I'm choosing him not, I don't necessarily know much about his baking, but the story of the night the Titanic went down is astonishing with him. The ship hit the iceberg at 11:40 at night on the 14th of April, and he was off duty, he was in his bunk, and he felt the collision, got up, word got round, he sent his 13 men up on deck with provisions for the lifeboats. Mm-hmm. So obviously they needed to, you know, keep people alive in them. 4 loaves of bread apiece, about 40 pounds of bread each. He stayed behind, then followed them up, reached the boat deck about an hour after they hit the iceberg. And he joined Chief Officer Henry Wilde at Lifeboat 10, helping women and children onto the boat. After a while, some of the women ran away because they thought they'd be safer on the Titanic than in these tiny boats in the North Atlantic. And Jochen went onto A deck, forcibly grabbing women and children and throwing them into the lifeboat to get them off the Titanic. He was then assigned as the captain to Lifeboat 10. And this happens on cruise ships nowadays. Like, weird people end up in charge of the emergency procedures. Mm. Like, I know musical theatre people who are like, if there's something going wrong and the ship needs to be evacuated, they're the emergency staff. So, like, musical theatre performers who are like, oh, suddenly we're putting on our high-vis and waving a torch and saying this way to the emergency exits. Is that who you want in charge of your evacuation?
Well, I don't know. At least they'll be able to be a good human siren.
Yes, maybe so. He didn't board the boat he was meant to be on. It was already manned. There were a couple of sailors and a steward on board. He said, they don't need me.
Mm-hmm.
He went back down after the boat had gone and had a drop of liquor in his quarters.
Good lad.
Yeah, as you'd imagine. He got back to the boat deck. All the boats had been lowered at that point, so he went down to A deck promenade and began throwing deck chairs overboard so people could use them as flotation devices. And then Jochen went to the pantry to get a drink of water. And at that point, the moment the Titanic lists and begins to tip happened, the sort of the tipping point of the water coming in happened. And he ended up clinging to a rail. He was on the outside of the ship, at the prow, at the very front of it, as the ship was going down. So as the ship sank, he rode it down like it was an elevator, keeping his head above water until the very last second. He was probably then the last survivor to leave the Titanic, because he was on the tip of it as it went down.
Oh my God.
Yeah. He kept paddling and treading for water for about 2 hours. Eventually spotted collapsible B, one of the lifeboats, which had overturned, and he swam towards it, but there was no room for him on it. But there was one man, a cook, who recognised him and held his hand to sort of keep and while he was on the boat, so he's holding him while he was in the water with his feet and legs still in the water, and so eventually a lifeboat appeared and he swam onto it, got inboard, and then was rescued by the Carpathia when it arrived. And he only suffered swollen feet from the whole incident. He went back to Britain, moved to America permanently, was on board the SS Oregon when it sank in Boston Harbor,
of course,
and served on various other ships.
God,
and
is he like that cat who sank three or more different ships?
It sounds like it. He was on various other ships and on a World War II transporter as well, and retired in 1944. Bravery in the face of duty, appropriately for a baker, rose to the occasion.
Very good.
Even if he was left with a soggy bottom at the end of it all.
Very nice. So, my suggestion is a gentleman called Otto Frederick Rohweder. And he was clearly of Germanic stock, but he was actually American, born in Davenport, Iowa in 1880. The son of Klaus and Elizabeth Rohweder. You don't need to know that. I just like saying the word Klaus. He moved down south. He had a brief career as a jeweller and owned three jewellery stores, but he had a passion for inventing machines. And this is why I think he's important, not really because he's a baker, but because he developed a machine. His prototype was suddenly destroyed in a fire in 1917, as were the blueprints. So it took him a further decade before his machine was perfected. What machine do you think he invented?
The bread knife. Before the best thing since sliced bread, you needed the bread knife. He invented a bread slicer.
He invented the bread slicer.
No way.
Yes, he made sliced bread.
Oh, it's so good.
A reality. He successfully designed it in 1927. It didn't just slice the bread, but it wrapped it as well.
Oh, amazing.
He got patents and sold the first machine to a friend and baker called Frank Bench, who installed it at the Chillicothe Baking Company in Missouri. And the first loaf of sliced bread was sold commercially on July the 27th, 1928.
And it was the best thing since whatever had come before that. Cocaine.
A chap called Gustav Papendick, who is a baker in St. Louis, bought his second bread slicer, and he set out various ways to improve it. After various different experiments, he managed to get a tray to align the slicers, which allowed mechanized wrapping machines to do things much, much quicker. And he improved it, and I think it may well have been his that went on to be popularized.
Right.
It also led to a burst of other inventions, including pop-up toasters, which had been invented by Charles Streit in 1926.
So they're like pop-up books.
Yeah.
What did happen? Oh, they just stayed in, and you had to sort of keep an eye on it beforehand.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Or you toasted it over a fire. You basically clamped it between two metal...
Yes, yeah.
And brilliantly, it also led to a boom in the consumption of bread, which meant to an increase in the consumption of spreads and jam, and a boon to the bread derivatives industry.
And to Marmite, which you would argue is the best outcome of all of that.
It absolutely is. In 1943, there was a ban in America on sliced bread to try and conserve it for wartime. It led to an outcry in many areas. There's even a quote in a story from one housewife who says, "I should like to let you know how important sliced bread is to the morale and saneness of a household. My husband and four children are all in a rush during and after breakfast. Without ready sliced bread, I must do the slicing for toast. 2 pieces for each one. That's 10. For their lunches, I must cut by hand at least 20 slices for 2 sandwiches apiece. Afterward, I make my own toast. 22 slices of bread to be cut in a hurry." To which I sort of want to say, calm down. The phrase, "the greatest thing since sliced bread..."
Tell me it was an advertising slogan.
So, in 1933, an advertisement for bread offering thick and thin slices in the same slove called it "the first improvement since sliced bread." And in 1940, a package of bread consisting of 2 wrapped half loaves was advertised as "the greatest convenience since sliced bread." And I think those 2 slogans were sort of smooshed together, and that's where the idiom came from.
Got
you. He's the man who invented sliced bread.
Can't argue with that.
So he's got to be the winner.
Yeah, very, very good. finally, we talked about the world's worst remake with Tom Crowley, and we picked the American remakes, I think all four of them, of the Fawlty Towers series. Americans tried and failed many times to make it work over there. What have you picked as the world's best remake?
So, as a bit of background, I'm going to go for one that I personally adore in a moment, but did you know that The Wizard of Oz is a remake?
Yeah.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, there was a stage show of it in the early 1900s, and it's a novel as well. And was there a silent film version of it?
There's a silent film and a Canadian cartoon.
Yeah.
And the silent film in 1925, directed by a chap called Larry Simon, who hilariously went on to make an adult film called The Sex Killer. It introduces new characters and exploits as a totally different plot. Dorothy is very much 18-year-olds rather than a pre-teen, as Judy Garland attempts to portray her whilst being 20 years old or whatever.
With her breasts being strapped down.
Were they?
Yeah.
Oh, of course, that makes sense. The focus in his film is much more on the Scarecrow character.
Ah.
The Tin Man, Cowardly Lion and Scarecrow are not actual characters, but disguises donned by three farmhands after they're swept into Oz by a tornado. And in a much more radical debacle from the book, the Tin Man is portrayed as a villain. It was reasonably well reviewed. In the New York Times, they described it as boasting of being the type of rough-and-tumble farce that sends bright faces from the theatre. Photoplay, a Chicago-based publication, said, "If you don't take your children to see this, they will never forgive you."
Hmm.
Adding, "Nothing is quite so funny as Larry Simon in the role of the Scarecrow, and the biggest grouch in the world will get a laugh out of his antics with the lions."
Hmm. I mean, given it's fallen into obscurity and The Wizard of Oz is objectively one of the greatest films ever, that's a pretty high bar to set for the world's best remake, yet you're still not picking that.
I have always loved the remake of The Thomas Crown Affair.
Ah, interesting.
I'm not one who thinks about this much in films, because it's not my sort of film, but I think it's genuinely one of the sexiest films ever made. I think it is peak Brosnan. As
it really is,
like, smooth, charming, high class man, far better than when he's Bond, and he's a decent Bond for his first two or three Bond movies.
Yeah,
but he playing a bored billionaire. Rene Russo is one of the sexiest women ever to have appeared on screen, and the game of catch and mouse between them is so wonderful.
Yeah, it's great. There's quite a sexy Bond bit in it. Isn't there a ball that they dance at one point in it? I think there's like a
very possible. Yeah. Well, the famous sexy scene in the original is Steve McQueen playing chess.
Yes,
but that just was so brilliantly spoofed by Austin Powers. I can't take it seriously.
Yeah, exactly.
And also because it has. The motif of Magritte's businessman with the apple in front of his face, and I just adore Magritte. I think he's a brilliant artist. Right at the end, because Rene Russo plays a brilliant "don't fuck with me" detective.
Well, she's the insurance investigator. She's not a cop, but she's sort of tailing the cops.
Yeah,
Dennis Leary plays the.
Yeah, I mean, that is, how can I put it? That is the one black mark against it, that you have a Poundland Bill Hicks in it.
Yeah, he's quite good in the film.
Well, that's the thing. Like,
nobody's bad in the film.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I'm not a fan of Dennis Leary's stand-up, but he's perfectly cast well. I say he's perfectly cast. Clearly they couldn't afford Woody Harrelson.
Yeah.
But just the final reveal when she thinks that he was just her plaything.
Yeah.
And then he reveals himself behind her on the plane, and it gets me. Every time.
It's so good. And we love a good heist scene played out well.
Yeah. Well, and of course, it introduced me to one of the best songs of all time, which is Nina Simone's Cinnamon. Because that's the soundtrack when all the different Magritte businessmen are wandering around the gallery. It is perfect.
Although it's not that painted this year, it's a Monet painting, I think, isn't it?
It's a Monet painting that's stolen.
Yeah.
But again, spoiler alert, but it's been out for 20 years.
Yeah.
When, you know, the sprinklers turn on and then they rain on it and it reveals the painting underneath.
Yeah, it's so good.
It's everything about it is satisfying as clockwork, and it is, and this is the best review I can give of any film, if it's on the television at any point, then I must stop everything and watch it. It is that kind of movie.
Very good. Yeah, good choice. Do you know what the first and only remake to win a Best Picture Oscar is?
That is outstanding trivia. I mean, does Silence of the Lambs count?
Nope. So, by remake, I mean a new version of an existing movie, not an adaptation of something. So, for example, there's things that didn't win. Mutiny on the Bounty, the 1963 Mutiny on the Bounty won Best Picture, but it's not a remake of the silent film of the Mutiny on the Bounty. It's an original movie inspired by the same event. True Grit was nominated, mm-hmm. which is a remake in 2010. It was a remake, but it lost to The King's Speech.
Right.
The only remake to win Best Picture is The Departed.
That's a remake?
Yeah. It's a remake of a Hong Kong film called Internal Affairs, which came out in 2002. And The Departed won Best Picture in 2006. So it's a really quick turnaround for a remake. The Departed, one of the lesser Scorsese's, but they had to eventually give him a Best Director nom.
Yeah, it's the well done for continuing to be Martin Scorsese.
Yeah. But like you, I adore Little Shop of Horrors. When I was in university, I directed a stage version of it, and I've been to see the stage show, professional versions of the stage show, a couple of times, and the movie directed by Frank Oz with
Rick Moranis, Rick,
and Steve Martin, Ellen Green, and all of that. It's a remake of a 1960 film.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's the 1960 film has been called the best film that was ever shot in 2 days. that's not entirely true. It was director Roger Corman bet his brother Gene that he could rehearse and shoot an entire film during the last week of 1959. He used leftover sets from an earlier film, spent Monday through Wednesday rehearsing and going through it with the actors, and then shot it on Thursday and Friday. They did then go a couple of reshoots and stuff like that over the following couple of weekends, but basically made the whole film in a week. And it's really critically well received. Rotten Tomatoes gives it an approval rating of 92% based on 12 reviews. Variety wrote that the acting is pleasantly preposterous. Horticulturalists and vegetarians will love it. And it features one of the first film roles of one of the greatest screen actors of all time. Jack Nicholson's in it. He plays like the sadomasochist who goes to the dentist.
Huh.
So he says he remembers seeing the audience laughing so hard I could barely hear the dialogue. I didn't quite register it right. It was as if I had forgotten it was a comedy since the shoot. I got all embarrassed because I'd never really had such a positive response before. Huh. Nicholson also said that Corman was so tight-fisted he wouldn't even pay to make extra copies of the script. And then it was released and became sort of popular as like you say, just be on TV, a bit like Thomas Cranford. They just would show it every now and again. And then inspired a off-Broadway show, premiered in 1982, the musical that people will know. And it ran for 2,209 performances over the next 5 years.
Bloody hell.
At that time, it was the highest grossing off-Broadway production ever. The $25 million film adaptation was released in 1986, as I say, directed by Frank Oz, voice of Yoda and Fozzie Bear, and so an expert in puppetry, which features heavily in the film. The plant, Audrey 2, had 6 different animatronic fly traps. The smallest one was only 4 inches tall. The largest one was 12 foot in height. And it had 60 human operators working it, including Brian Henson, who's Jim Henson's son.
Yeah.
And I think his sister also makes a cameo as like a patient at the dentist's office as well. So there are a couple of Henson involvements in it. Apparently, when the foam lips on Audrey 2, when they're singing to sync up the audio, couldn't move quite fast enough. So they would film the plant at a slower rate, at 12 or 14 or 16 frames per second, then sped it up. Which then meant that Rick Moranis, when he was duetting side by side with it, had to basically lip sync in slow motion. And they cut quite a lot of the songs from the musical when they made the film. But Somewhere That's Green made it in, which is maybe the most famous song from it. Audrey sings about yearning to move out of the inner city into the suburbs. And it's what's called an I Want song. The character basically sings what their biggest desire is, tells the audience that. And it's composed by Howard Ashman and Alan Menken, who worked together on it. They wrote the musical as well. And they later wrote quite a lot of Disney stuff.
Yeah, they wrote all the songs from The Little Mermaid.
Exactly. They wrote Part of Your World. And Alan Menken has joked that they used to call that one Somewhere That's Wet. It's basically the same thing in a different context. Bill Murray appears in it as sort of the Jack Nicholson type character who's the sadomasochist who goes to Steve Martin's dentist. He basically said he wants to ad-lib his way through the entire scene. So that film is entirely ad-libbed, basically.
Of course it is.
Yeah, use different lines in every take. It also has appearances by Jim Belushi, John Candy and Christopher Guest, as well as Bill Murray appearing. Yeah, hell of a cast. Audrey 2 sings the song Mean Green Mother from Outer Space, which was written specifically for the film. Because if you want to win a Best Original Song Oscar, you got to write an original song. It's no good using the songs from the musical. And so, yeah, Mean Green Mother has a few swears in it. And so they had to, you know, edit it a little bit for the actual Oscar broadcast. It was performed by Levi Stubbs, the R&B singer, the lead singer of the Four Tops. It sadly, it lost out to Top Gun's Take My Breath Away. Which seems wrong somehow.
Little bit. I mean, I could imagine Audrey singing that as well.
Yeah, completely. You know that the ending of the film is different to the musical as well.
Can I make my confession now?
You haven't seen it?
No.
The film or the musical?
I've not seen the film. I saw a production of the musical put on by my mum's school when I was about 14. It was pretty good.
Okay, so you might remember the ending of the musical, if they did the actual ending for the musical, is that the plants take over the entire planet.
Right.
Yeah. And the song is Don't Feed the Plants is the final number, which is great. The original actual, the Corman's version of it, Seymour grabs a knife, leaps into Audrey 2, kills the plant and himself.
Yeah.
The musical, the plants take over the entire planet. The movie, slightly different. Frank Oz spent 1/5 of the entire movie's budget, that's $5 million, filming the end of the film. Creating like a huge elaborate sequence referencing Godzilla, War of the Worlds, loads of sci-fi things. Took just under a year to do this final couple of minutes of the film, basically. And then they ran test previews of it in front of audiences in San Jose, and audiences loved it. The whole thing, every musical number, there was applause. It was just fantastic, Oz said, until we killed our two leads. Then the theatre became a refrigerator, an icebox. It was awful. They had another screening in LA, same reaction. He decided we just had to cut the ending, make it a happy ending or a satisfying ending or something. We couldn't release it with that reaction. So Howard Ashman rewrote a happier ending where Audrey and Seymour end up moving to the suburbs and marrying. It's sort of a reprise of Somewhere That's Green. But they have put the deleted ending back onto the 2012 Director's Cut DVD.
Which ending do you prefer?
I love the ending in the musical. I love Don't Feed the Plants. It's just so dark and overblown and brilliant. It's too easy to go, oh, they kill the plant, they live happily ever after. But that's the cynic in me. And I just love I love the musical and I love the film. And given that came from a schlocky, whacked it together in a week, I don't think it even runs for 90 minutes, so it's barely a feature film, the original Corman film from 1960. I think it's a hell of a step up. So we've got the Thomas Crown Affair, and we've got this. And Ben is looking at me with those sheepdog eyes, going, please let me pick the Thomas Crown Affair.
No, do you know what? I love and adore it, but the cast list for your film, I think, beats the cast list for mine. Over, you know, Nicholson, Murray, Moranis.
Bear in mind that Nicholson is not in the remake.
No, I know, but he's in and around it.
Yeah, he's there or thereabouts.
And it's hard to judge because I've never seen it, but it's you feel even more personally invested in it having directed it, whereas Thomas Crown Affair, it's not getting anywhere near any of my top 10 films of all time list. It's just a warm bubble bath in a 5-star hotel,
yes,
for me. So I'm happy with Little Shop of Horrors to be the best remake.
So there it is. That's another 5 episodes back in the can, picking our best of the best. Thank you as ever for listening to Worst Foot Forward. It's a pleasure having you on board. And we're getting into winter. Got a few guests lined up for our winter episodes, and some exciting things happening in the new year, which we're not allowed to tell you about yet.
Yeah, but we will soon, in that we will, we can assure you soon, we will be doubling and redoubling our efforts to waggle our eyebrows at you in a Patreon key.
Yeah.
But for now, if you enjoy this, whether you're a new listener or old, if you want to help us out, go onto the podcast platform of your choice, leave us a 5-star review. It's the only one that's acceptable.
Yeah.
Because even now, after 2.5 years of podcasting, that stuff really helps get us noticed. We often oscillate into the top 50, 100, 200 in a country and then quickly ping out of there again.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's to do with reviews. So if loads of you give us a sexy review all at the same time, that helps us get seen more and appear in other people's feeds more. So more people will listen, which can only be a good thing. We now thoroughly recommend that you pop off and watch the classic Thomas Crown Affair, Little Shop of Horrors double bill.
Bye.
Bye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.